culture and history. David Swatling creates an oral tapestry.
Today we're going to hear about an unusual film premiere that took place in Istanbul. Unusual in that the Turkish film won the Golden Palm Award at the Cannes Film Festival 17 years ago, but is only now being screened in Turkey. But we begin with something called Scopatone. Not a medical procedure, or a skincare product, or a heavy metal band, or anything else that the name sounds like. Scopatone was a cultural phenomena of the 60s in France and the United States that combined a jukebox with a film projector, and voila, the result might be called the granddaddy of MTV music videos. Film archivist Jack Stevenson has been collecting these short musical films for years, and he brought a program of these often politically incorrect film oddities to Amsterdam.
People think that MTV is new, and in fact it had some important forerunners that started in 1939 with the Panoram visual jukebox that showed films that were called soundies, 3-minute black and white song and dance performances. The jukebox had a movie screen built right into it, and you could see as well as hear your favorite performers. That lasted through the war years. Production of films stopped during the war, but it was still very popular. And then around 1946, it just completely faded. It was a trend that played itself out, and in the late 50s, early 60s, it reappeared in the form of Scopatone. This time, the films were in color, and you could choose which song you wanted to hear. With the soundies, you would only get what was next on the roll, the reel of film. With Scopatone, you could choose, and the films were in color, and these were revolutionary changes that gave Scopatones the impact of a new invention.
But when they came back, they didn't come back in America first.
No, they were developed in France. After the end of the war, two French technicians started to tinker around with the idea of constructing a visual jukebox. And it was very strange because they used the mechanism that had been used by the French Air Force in the Second World War for high-altitude reconnaissance in their planes, which was a 16-millimeter film camera, which they converted to a 16-millimeter film projector. They worked on it until the late 50s because it was very difficult to get a jukebox that was bright enough, the screen was bright enough, and that the film mechanisms functioned properly with this much more complicated mechanisms than the soundies. But by 1960, the French had developed the machine and they started to place it around France.
French pop star Francis Audet's Tous les garçons et les filles, for the boys and the girls, is sung in an amusement park. And though the camera work is rather simple, it's not so unlike some of the videos you'd see on MTV without the fast-paced editing. But Scopatones were using film, and I couldn't quite picture how you could fit a film screen and projector into a jukebox, Stevenson explained.
The first one was about 5.5 feet tall, and it looked like a robot. The first two models, well, both models that were produced in France in 1960 and 62, had a detachable head, like a screen head. And because it had a detachable head, it did look like a robot. And then the second model, the ST-36 that they created in 1962, this was the model that was also shipped to the United States when this phenomenon came over to the U.S. And that was about 7 feet tall. That looked completely bizarre, completely monstrous. It was a monstrosity, basically. basically, and it weighed 650 pounds crated. If one of these things ever fell on you, it would kill you. It was also a visual thing, too. It was also, when you walked into a place, you could not ignore it. It was gigantic. It was in bars, taverns, bowling alleys, lounges, cafes, restaurants. In America, these jukeboxes took hold around 1963-64, and they were aimed at the more adult market. They were placed in high-fashion restaurants, casinos, places that young people didn't go, and places where jukeboxes had never been seen before. So they were aiming for a more sophisticated and high-class audience. And for a while, Scopitone had a reputation for being a high-class invention.
In terms of the look of the films, there seems to be a pretty strong difference between the French ones, which were a little earlier, and the American ones, which came later, or certainly a development.
Absolutely. It's a very stark difference. The French films were very low budget, and they were very reflecting a French mentality, very artistic, very conscious of history. There were a lot of historical themes. When the films began to be produced in America in early 1965 by Harmony Production Company in Hollywood, they reflected the American mentality. Bright colors, a lot of dance numbers, a lot of girls in bikinis, and a whole different mentality that's hard to describe. And in America, they didn't go for these historical themes. I mean, anything before 1955 was considered prehistoric. And they also wanted to get these films in English language. So for the first year in America, the machines played French productions, and everybody knew that if they didn't get American English language films into the machines, that it would be short-lived. When they did start to produce these films in America, they were produced by Harmony in Hollywood, and they developed their own style of cinema. They weren't setting out to develop a style of cinema, but they did it unintentionally, and it's an incredible look to these films, and they're very unique, and they remain so. Nobody has really approached the sense of innocent yet somehow bizarre camp that they put through. The use of colors, dance numbers, was just utterly weird.
When you mention innocence and camp, there's certainly a lot of these films that had what seems today, made the audience laugh anyway, kind of an innocent sexuality, you know, dresses being blown up by the wind. But there was a definite sort of sex appeal to them for the time.
Absolutely. It was about as much as they could get away with, and it was put forward in a way that was so innocent but so direct, so obvious. If it wasn't so innocently put forward, it might have been actually a little bit sleazy, but it was so innocent, and it was done usually with beautifully photographed. Women's dresses were always blowing up. The camera was always focusing in on crotches and stuff. I mean, it was obvious, and on legs and stuff like that. Very politically incorrect, and maybe sexist if we want to use a couple of modern terms that didn't even exist at the time. And they just tried to make them as addictive as possible, so you'd come back and keep dropping quarters, so you'd find a one that with a girl you liked in it or something, and just keep playing it and playing it until you spent all your rent money, you know.
Up every day at 6, bacon and eggs to fix, 4 kids from 1 to 4, pretty soon there'll be one more. I got old floors to wax and scrub, and there's a dirty old ring in the tub. I'll get a maid someday, but till then I'm of the house. No time to fix my hair. Need a new dress to wear. Old clothes will have to do, 'cause the kids all need new shoes. I got bridge club each Tuesday night. He goes out with the boys and gets tired, but when the evening's through, he comes home to the queen of the house.
I know. When I think of music from the 60s, you know, and the evolution of rock and roll from Elvis Presley and to the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, this was not the material for Scopatone.
No, Scopatone's never had the big rock stars. They never really wanted to sign on to that. In America, it became more with lounge singers, pop crooners. James Darren was a perfect example. Vic Damone, people like that. And the female stars like Gail Garnett, Debbie Reynolds, K-Star. This was the meat and potatoes of Scopatone. They never could have paid enough money to sign the big acts.
Now, there were a couple of examples of rock and roll Scopatone films.
Yes, there were. The leading executive of the American production company, Harmony, at one point told a reporter that they didn't care to get into the long-haired music. This was 65, 66. The hippie scenes were just starting in San Francisco and L.A. The Byrds were fairly big. They could see there was this so-called long-haired music starting up. But they were never, that was never their bag. They never got into it. But they did sign some acts like Gary Lewis and the Playboys, Bobby V. This was prime mid-60s pop rock with an accent firmly on pop. Let's see, Dion, Neil Sedaka did a great one, Paul Anka, but their specialty was people more like James Darren or Vic Damone. But the Exciters did a very good one. They would be considered a real rock and roll girl group from Philadelphia around the time of early Supremes. He's Got the Power was their big hit that they did a Scopatone of.
However, by 1969, Scopatones had disappeared from bars, lounges, and bowling alleys altogether. What happened?
Some of these films seemed just a bit too silly by 1968, but I think it just was a trend, it was a fashion, and it just went out of style. What's interesting is that in 1964, 65, is when you read about the history of these, was the expectation. They expected these things would go forever. They would be making hundreds of films a year. So they had this air of unreality about it. They wanted to play the same old songs for the old crooners, the old lounge crooners, and they thought that was they would be safe doing that, but they weren't safe. They became extinct.
Jack Stevenson's program, Scopatone A Go-Go, played last weekend at The Bali, Amsterdam's Center for Art and Politics. An unusual choice, considering how politically incorrect the film seemed today. But it was a refreshing break from what they usually show, films like the one that had an unusual premiere on Friday in Turkey. This weekend in Istanbul, moviegoers had a chance to see Yol, Turkey's most internationally successful film, for the very first time. What's remarkable is that it's been 17 years since the film's premiere at the Cannes Film Festival, where it was awarded the 1982 Golden Palm for Best Film. Yol means road and was made by the late Turkish filmmaker Yılmaz Güney, who died in exile in 1984, a year after he had been stripped of Turkish citizenship. Made just after the military coup in Turkey in 1980, the film is about five prisoners who escape from jail and traces their journeys back to their homes. Dorian Joan reports from Istanbul about Yol's long journey home to its native Turkey. Thank you.
the theme music for Yol. The film has been digitally remastered as well as having a new soundtrack for its commercial premiere in Turkey 17 years after it was made. The main driving force behind its final release is Fatoş Gürney, wife of Yol's maker, Yılmaz Gürney, and the head of the Yılmaz Gürney Foundation. As she explains, it's been a long struggle to bring the film to Turkish audiences.
Yılmaz Gürney 10 yıl boyunca ülkesinde yasaklıydı. 12 Eylül döneminde Türkiye'den ayrıldıktan sonra tüm geride kalan filmlerinin negatifleri topladı.
He was banned 10 years ago, and even after the ban, we had problems finding cinemas prepared to show, as well as finding funding to support the project. We set up the Yılmaz Gürney Foundation, and it's been a long struggle to bring the film finally to Turkey. Even after the official ban was lifted, we still face problems. There was a kind of unofficial ban, especially the film Yol, which drew so much international applause. Yılmaz Gürney has always been targeted by the state. After he left the country, the state destroyed 104 of his films, lost forever. They tried to destroy everything, but in the minds and hearts of people, he's always remained.
The premiere of Yol has created great interest within the Turkish movie world. Here at the Turkish Cinema Awards, the country's leading filmmakers and actors and actresses attend the annual event. The large attendance and media attention is a testament to the increasing strength of the movie industry, which until the last few years has been in the doldrums. The industry suffered heavily from censorship and state control following the military coup in 1980. Speaking to those attending, the final release of Yol is seen as putting those years to rest, although a feeling of anger still remains.
It's very, very, very late, but better than nothing. But as I say, I mean, it's very late. It's a big shame that it was banned at all. As a filmmaker and also as a thinker, a thinking filmmaker, he had immense influence. This way or that way, I mean, it's you don't have to be a fan of Yılmaz Gürney, but is extremely important.
We were hoping since long time ago that if you could see Yılmaz Gürney's most of his movies, but unfortunately he had some restrictions. That's unfortunate for Turkey because he's, I guess, the father of Turkish movie cinema. The way that he tried to show Turkish society's problems, they still exist in Turkey, and his movie is never gonna be old-fashioned if this political situations continues like that. I mean, the scenario, the subjects are from the real life. He was one of the like the villagers or the poor people. He reflected that into the cinema. That's why I think he's important for Turkish cinema.
The organizer of the awards ceremony, film critic Atullah Dorsay, has been in the forefront of campaigning to end the country's censorship laws and bring Gurney's films back to Turkey. But while censorship is no longer a major problem in Turkish cinema today, and many of Gurney's films have been shown, Yol until now hasn't been commercially released. The film is set just after the military coup in 1980 and tells the story of five escaped prisoners returning to their homes. But it doesn't just focus on the grim reality of life in Turkey after the coup, but looks at relationships between men and their families, as well as raising issues of gender and culture within Turkish society. According to Dorsay, Yol is not only important for Turkish cinema, but also for the whole film world.
The film, for my opinion, is one of the milestones of not only the Turkish cinema, but of the film history. I recently wrote two books in a row, The 100 Directors of the Cinema History of 100 Years and The 100 Films of 100 Years. I didn't think even a second to include a Turkish director, but I included gladly Yol within my 100 best films of the centenary because I think it's an important film. You know, it is a film which made the opening of the Third World cinema to the Western audiences again. The Western audiences knew the Third World cinema back to the mid-50s, thanks to the directors such as Satyajit Ray and some other people. But then, with the years passing by during the late 60s and the 70s, practically no film could commercially reach the Western cinema world, and Yol was the first exception, because not only that it was awarded in Cannes, but it was widely shown all over the world, and this is still the film which the Western audiences know the Turkish cinema with or by. So I think the film has a big historical value and artistic value, and it was a pity that it was never shown in Turkey commercially.
What is remarkable about Gurney's films is not only their content, but also how they were made. For most of his films were made while he was in prison, including Yol. Gurney spent most of the 70s in jail for killing a judge, although the circumstances surrounding the killing still remain disputed. But being in jail didn't stop Gurney from being a prolific movie maker, with a strong political and social agenda. Atulla Dorsai again.
He always wanted to be involved directly in the politics. He openly criticized the militaries, but he was unable to do that openly because he was in prison. As you know, he was accused by murdering a judge in 74, I think, and he spent the rest of his time in prison. And for the first time in the history of cinema, he made a kind of tele-guided movies, which means he wrote the script, and as he was unable to shoot them himself, he gave the work to his assistants, which all became later on well-known directors, of course, such as Sherif Gören, the director of Yol, actually. But he was, even if he wasn't on the set, he followed closely what was happening. He was able to see the rushes thanks to the special system in the Turkish prisons and to the huge prestige and authority he owned. And he gave them orders about the shooting of the next day, about the cutting, about the music, about the actors who were changed sometimes in the middle of a shooting, you know. A leading one was replaced by another one upon to his wish, etc., etc. So he had a firm control upon his works, and that was a unique case, of course, of the cinema history.
In fact, life reflected fiction, for Gurney, like the characters in the film Yol, escaped from prison just after the filming ended. He fled to Paris, where he edited and produced the film. But like many of his films, Yol was shot while he was in jail, with him contributing to the direction of the film through detailed scripts and meetings with the director. Sherif Gören, the director of Yol.
1981'de, yani 12 Eylül 1980 olağanüstü dönemin, yani askeri yönetimin.
It was 1981, just after the 12 September military coup, when Yılmaz Güney contacted me. I visited him in prison where he gave me the scenario for Yol. I was a second director, as Güney had problems with the first director. He gave me the script and said, shoot the film as you see it. It was very difficult to keep in contact with Yılmaz in prison, and I was shooting in one of the wildest places in Turkey in the middle of winter. But I'd worked many times like this, with Yılmaz being in prison, so it wasn't such a problem. We didn't have many problems shooting either. Even local soldiers appeared in the film. But once Yılmaz escaped from prison, the trouble really started, and got worse after it won the Golden Palm in Cannes. I was prosecuted by the authorities, and as I was banned from leaving the country, I couldn't even go to Cannes. I just had to go to court.
But while the days of censorship of films in Turkey for the most part are over, a new generation of film directors have come to the fore. Recent successes by these directors have heralded what many claim is the start of a renaissance in the Turkish film industry. Here at an editing studio in Istanbul, one of the new generation of directors, Mustafa Altıokla, is in post-production for his latest film. He too has courted controversy with portrayals of police brutality and torture in his last film, Ar Roman, which was one of Turkey's most successful films. Although Altıokla believes the film industry has changed a lot from the days of Gurney, he acknowledges he has left an important legacy.
But I watched that film and many Yılmaz Güney's film from Greek TV. I was at my obligatory work on medicine in a small town near the Greek border, and we were able to watch his film from Greek TV, especially the ideas, political ideas, and the point of view of Güney was very important for the country. That is the important point. Yılmaz Güney's films is standing those socio-political problems. That's very important. It was the, I said, they were the first films who were quarreling those things. Surely I'm influenced of his life and his struggle.
While Güney is generally credited with bringing a social reality and a political dimension to Turkish cinema, the success and importance of Güney's films lies not only in its depiction of social reality, but their accessibility to audiences, according to Atilla Dorsay. He argues that it was Güney, the storyteller, that made him so important to Turkish cinema and the key to his success around the world.
Although the story continued to be part of the Turkish reality, he always knew to add something like a legend, you know, something which is stylized enough so that the film had an epic dimension. Then you look at a film such as Yol. The film doesn't only show the political reality of those days, and not only depicts an accumulation of human tragedies, of human dramas, but it also becomes a big epic, you know, because the behaviors of people at some points are not only dramatic, but they are tragical. So it goes beyond the limitations of daily stories, and it becomes something like a very human or humanist drama, which becomes, you know, very universal, and which also becomes timeless. It becomes so timeless that you start not to be able to forget that scene, that particular scene, or the whole film anymore. So this is something which is new for our cinema, you know. Unforgettable stories which belong to the whole human race and which are practically timeless, which could happen anytime, anywhere, in any country. Years ago, they have given me a list of the countries where Yol has been shown, but it was incredible. It has been shown not only in the big Western countries, including the United States, of course, but in much smaller countries, going from Luxembourg to Taiwan, and it was incredible. In every country, the film had found a certain audience, and that's unique, of course, in our history, in the history of the Turkish cinema, that's unique.
With Yol's premiere, in many ways it could be facing its greatest test. For in Turkey, commercial success depends on winning the favour of the country's notoriously fickle and critical young film-going population, many of whom weren't even born when the film was made, being brought up on a diet of highly produced Hollywood imports. But Fatoş Güney believes that the film still has something to say to audiences today, especially the young.
O kadar uzun yıllara rağmen Türkiye'de pek bir şey değişmedi.
Yes, 17 years have passed since the film was made, but some things in this country don't change. Many of the problems faced by the characters in the film remain today. Social injustice, the oppression of women. The film challenges many of the old traditions in this country, which have and still cause so much suffering. And it will offer, especially the young, a challenge to those traditions.
Haunting music from the soundtrack of the Turkish film Yol bring Dorian Jones' report and this edition of Oral Tapestry to an end. My thanks to Ruud van Steenis for the technical production. Till next time, I'm David Swadling. Thanks for listening.